KFSR presents First Ladies Focus, the personal stories behind people who love Fresno State. Featuring Fresno State's First Lady, Mrs. Mary Castro, and KFSR Program Director, Julie Logan, 90.7 KFSR.
Good morning and welcome. I'm Julie Logan, along with my co-host, Fresno State First Lady, Mrs. Mary Castro. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning, Julie.
Thanks for joining us this morning. We're excited to have another very special guest with us today. And as always, Mary has the introductions.
Yes, we are very excited this morning. This has been an interview I've been looking forward to for a while, and I'm happy to finally have our special guest in here with us. And that is our Dean of College and Social Sciences, Dr. Michelle Dinbeste. Welcome.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us.
I know we've rescheduled a few times and things got in the way, but you were appointed as the permanent dean almost a year ago to the date, right?
It's kind of hard to believe, actually. Time has flown.
And a lot has happened in that first year. But before we get started about all the exciting things that have happened in the year that you've been the permanent dean, and before that you were the interim dean for 2 years, so you really had a great feel for the college and the programs there. I wanted to take us back to where this all started and your area of interest and expertise, because I find it fascinating. They sent me your vita and it's 7 pages long, and I was just blown away that, you know, I think that it's incredible when a person really finds that thing that they love to do so much that they just keep building upon it. And it looks like that's what you've been able to do. So you said that you started off, you were born in Oregon, but you had an interesting path as you were going through grade school. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I moved around a lot. Despite what people think, my father was not in the military. He was just a guy trying to move up the corporate ladder, sort of. Mm-hmm. So I was born in Oregon. My family's mostly in Oregon, but we moved briefly when my brother was little to Seattle, and then we moved. My dad got a job with McDonnell Douglas in St. Louis. And so we moved to St. Louis, Missouri, a time which my mother absolutely hated. The whole time we were there, she wanted to move someplace else. I remember her talking about it.
Was she anti-snow? Was that the thing?
She was anti-hot weather. Hated the summers. She hated the humidity. Mm. I think she didn't like being far away from family either, where she had 2 little kids.
Oh, that's difficult.
And she just hated the weather and the bugs. But the snakes.
But she conveyed that to your dad, right?
Yes. And I remember, I was pretty little, but I remember her just telling him, we have to move. When are we moving? I think he wasn't looking hard enough for a job. He probably sort of liked his job.
Uh-huh.
But eventually we did just up and move. We packed the moving truck. We were driving across the country. He'd applied for a bunch of different jobs. And as we're driving across, he found out that he actually had a job.
Oh, wow.
So the plan was to live with my grandparents for a little while we figured out what we're doing. So we still did do that, but not for very long. And then we moved to Seattle, where I went to junior high and high school, and I wound up going to college there eventually.
Uh-huh.
My plan was to not stay in my hometown school, but that is not what happened.
I think that happens a lot where students want to try something different, and then you realize what you really have at home is you develop an appreciation for it, right? So when you were in Seattle, what was your middle school and high school experience like?
Well, we moved there when I was in 8th grade, and it was pretty awful, actually. 8th grade, I think, is hard for lots of people. It's not a good year. And I'm the new kid. I've just moved there. So it's kind of tough year, I think, to move. I've always been a good student. I always liked school. And suddenly, I hated going to school for lots of reasons. But I finally came home one day and told my parents that I was never going back to school.
Never.
Which was probably not realistic, but that was how I saw it.
And you're still in school every single day now. So you didn't hold true to that promise.
So my mom took me seriously. And there was a girls' Catholic high school that was, I could walk to it.
Oh, great.
My parents were not private school kind of people. We were not Catholic. But I was the miserable child and they made it work. And so I wound up at this Catholic girls' school for high school, which for me was, it was just amazing. I think that it allowed me to do all the things that I did later because education mattered. These girls, many of them had had a private school education. They were much better educated than I was, but I caught up. I found friends. I found my niche in high school, actually.
So that ended up being the real positive move for you, even though it wasn't something that your family had planned on doing before. They had planned on keeping you in the public school system, right?
Yeah, they would never have sent me to private school. And it wasn't that easy for them either. We didn't really have enough money to pay for this private school. My mom wound up, she had worked as a secretary off and on. And so she asked the school if she could like be a secretary in exchange for my tuition. And they said, no, you can't do that. But she wound up getting a job there.
Oh, that sounds familiar because I used to clean houses to trade for my tuition at Riverdale Christian Academy because my parents couldn't do it. And so, you know, you find a way to make it happen because I loved the school so much and I didn't want to leave it when it looked like I couldn't stay there. I'm glad to hear that that was a positive experience for you. Is that where you developed your curiosity in Russia and studying the Russian language and Eastern European studies? How did that come about? When did you start getting excited about those areas?
It kind of started there. I always liked history and English. I always loved to read. When I was in high school, it was, well, kind of mid-80s. So it was sort of the new Cold War. It was the Reagan era.
Mm-hmm.
There was lots of talks about, you know, nuclear bombs and this sort of thing.
And exciting things on TV. I remember those.
And so my high school had possibilities for us to go to different kinds of seminars. And there was, I can't remember exactly what it was, but some kind of peace in the world sort of seminar that I got to go to and wrote some sort of essay for. I didn't have the opportunity to go to Russia until I was almost, well, I guess I was in graduate school when I finally got to go. But I think it sort of started there. It started with my history classes. It started because some of my classmates at this school were much more politically conservative than I was and teased me as, you know, you're a communist, which I was not a communist.
Oh my gosh.
But that was
the accusation started early, right?
They did.
So you said that at first you moved away to go to college, but then you went back to Seattle. So was history always your major or did you change that? Did you start out with something different and then go
to started
history?
Out wanting to major in English. I loved to read. I had always loved English. I loved my literature classes in high school.
Well, English and history pair together perfectly.
This is true. But I did not love my English classes in college. I went my first year to St. Olaf, a small Lutheran college in Minnesota.
Okay.
And it was okay, but I didn't love it. What I did love was they have kind of an interesting freshman class and you choose a theme and you take a couple classes around that.
Mm-hmm.
So I wound up taking a Russian history class and Russian language there. And my professor there is like, I don't know why you've come so far away to study with me. The University of Washington has an amazing Russian studies program. Why are you here? And I'm like, I don't know.
So when did you really start getting into, because you speak and read Russian, don't you?
Well, used to speak and read it better, but yes, I do. I do read it pretty well. My spoken Russian has gotten quite rusty, but at some point I lived there and was relatively fluent.
But does anyone else in your family?
No.
No. So this was your
thing. This was me being a rebel.
But I love that this was your thing that you got excited about. And what were some of the mentors that you had along the way that helped to reinforce your passion for studying history in Russia?
Well, I think partly I was just stubborn because Russian did not come easily. It's the only class that I almost actually flunked. I had to take it over again because I did so badly and I'm a good student. So this was horribly traumatic.
But you seek out challenges.
Apparently. Apparently I'm stubborn. But I did have my language professors. I'm not sure were exactly mentors because they were scary. My Russian language professor at the University of Washington was this older woman who had lived through the siege of Leningrad, which she told us all the time.
Wow.
I'm struggling in Russian and sort of life because I was a college student and I've missed some class and I go to class and I tell her, look, I'm really sorry. I'm working to make sure this happens, but I'm not quite up to speed. And she tells me, well, you know, you can take this test later, but I don't really know what to tell you because I taught class the day my husband died. So, you know, you just need to get your act together.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I guess if that's someone you're trying to get some empathy from, it's not going to happen.
But, you know, I did keep working at it because I thought, well, all right, fine. I guess I have to get my act together. And I did, apparently.
Right.
But I had a lot of really good friends.
She sounds like a tough woman. And
she was Russian. She did live through the siege of Leningrad. She, you know, it's just, there's no excuses. You have to do it.
So you said that the first time you were able to actually go to Russia was when you were a graduate student. What type of a program was that a part of? Or did you just put on a backpack and go?
Kind of. So when I was an undergraduate, it was kind of hard to go to Russia and you had to be a really good student, which I was not a really good student of Russian, clearly, because you had to be chosen. It was all the state-sponsored programs. But in 1989, as Russia's starting to crumble, there begins to be a few more opportunities for folks to just kind of go with new types of programs. So at that point, I've gone to graduate school in Illinois and met a professor there. He was American. His wife was French. He was teaching my Russian history classes, and he had gotten a IREX grant to go and study and do research in Russia for a year. Mm-hmm. And they had a two-year-old daughter. And so I went as their nanny to Russia with them. And this was in before my son was born. So maybe 91, 92, early 90s, Russia was really an interesting place about then. And it was a great opportunity for me. It was hard in a lot of ways because they'd go all day and leave me home with this child.
I was wondering how you'd be able to fit in time to venture out and explore and
learn things. You're with a two-year-old, and I didn't want to be stuck in an apartment all day.
Right.
So we did go out, and I talked to people in ways I probably wouldn't have without the child. We'd go to the playground. They only speak Russian, so I have to make it work. She learned Russian, actually, while we were there. She's two.
We
did the grocery shopping, so we'd go to the markets and haggle with the market sellers, and they're working all day. And it was a time when food was not plentiful. There were ration coupons that we got, so I'd go spend their ration coupons, try to make sure we had like fruits and vegetables and enough to
You had the real day-to-day living experience of what a family in that time and in that place would have.
I did.
And so how long were you there for that? That was a year?
I was there not quite a year, almost a year. And then I came back and then I didn't get to go back again. I can't quite remember. I guess I went back briefly after that. And then I had moved here before I got to go back again.
Oh, okay. It says that your research focuses on women doctors in the 19th century. How did you narrow it down to that specific area?
Partly happenstance. I learned about these women kind of accidentally. I was going to graduate school at Southern Illinois, which does not have a giant Russian studies program. Mm-hmm. And so much like here, you take classes that are available that are kind of in your field, but they might not be exactly in your field.
Mm-hmm.
So I was taking a European history class and it was sort of on immigration issues. And I didn't want to do immigration per se. So I'm looking for something that has to do with Russia that I can make work. And I come across these women who have gone to Zurich. They're Russian, but they've gone to Zurich to study medicine. And so I start reading more and more, and I find out that there's actually quite a number of these people. So I just kind of kept digging from there, and it turned into my dissertation and later articles.
But they weren't being reflected in history. They weren't being given the proper recognition when you did your research.
Yeah, there hadn't been a ton written about them. One of the things I wanted to do was study women who weren't revolutionaries, because there was a fair amount written about women revolutionaries, but there wasn't a lot written about other people. I mean, there were bits and pieces about these women here and there in different venues, but there wasn't just kind of a concentrated study of them. And the ones that there were studies of were the ones who were also revolutionaries.
Okay.
And as I studied them more, my thing came to be that they are revolutionary in a way, but they're not out throwing bombs. They're revolutionary in the sense that they go to medical school at this time when women aren't necessarily doing that, and they come to really care about their patients. They're often working in real rural areas. And so they become advocates for rural health care. They become advocates for more money into medicine. To the government at that time, late 19th century, this does kind of make them dangerous because it's sort of antithetical to what's going on. And they're talking about a lot of the issues of the day. They're talking about professional medicine. They're talking about less government interference and paying attention to professionals. But they don't portray themselves anyway as being revolutionary. I mean, to some extent,
because
it's
in their
a bit
opinion,
of a lie, but
they're following what they feel like they're called to do.
Yeah, they're doctors. You know, they see themselves as doctors. They're medical professionals. They see themselves as knowing about their field. Mm-hmm. They recognize that the politics of the day are kind of in the way of that. For a lot of reasons, they don't talk about that necessarily.
What were some of the challenges that were unique to them being women doctors in Russia versus being a woman doctor in the United States at that same time?
Well, actually, they're pretty much pioneers. Women aren't allowed to go to a regular medical school and get a regular medical education. They can go to these water healing schools. They can go to the homeopathic schools, but they can't go to medical school.
Mm-hmm.
And this was true in much of Europe as well. So in Russia, they let them go to regular medical school, but they get a different degree that says they can only treat women and children.
Oh.
But then they're sent off to these places in the middle of nowhere where there aren't any doctors. So, of course, it's not really practical. You're going to just send the man away. I can't treat men.
Right. More like a glorified midwife.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But they wind up, of course, treating everyone because they take on these rural practices where there are no doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a particular time where there aren't enough doctors in Russia. The numbers are very small. So they're not exactly in love with the idea of women doctors, but by necessity, they kind of get in.
Yes.
A lot of places are willing to hire them because they can pay them less. It's cheaper to hire a woman than a man.
Right.
They have a really, really good education. They've gotten an education that's on par with what any doctor of the time would have gotten.
And they're probably getting a lot more hands-on experience by being in those rural areas where they are the person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Some of the first women doctors, they go to war while they're still in medical school in the Crimean War when Florence Nightingale is becoming this big model. It's the Crimean War and Florence Nightingale, women in nursing and all that. Well, these women are in medical school and the war breaks out and they go to the front and they assist. They're not doctors yet.
Mm-hmm.
But they get the experience of working in wartime conditions. And when they come back, one of the interesting things is that whereas in England, it's, oh, Florence Nightingale and, oh, women can be nurses. In Russia, it's, oh, look, these women served in battle-time conditions, and they could be doctors.
They could be a doctor, yeah.
So for a variety of reasons, it happens
differently. The light bulbs go on, right. Yes. So what is the project that you're working on now? I see that it's about a church here in the Central Valley.
Yeah, it's a group called the Balakons. They split from the Orthodox Church way back in like the 17th century. And then they eventually flee Russia because they're not Orthodox and because they're also pacifists. And this is a huge problem in Russia because every man has to serve in the military. So a group of them, there's a prophecy and a vision that they should leave and go to this place. And
how large is this group?
I don't know how large they are when they leave. There's thousands of them here still.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of them are still in the church, and there's been splits in the church since then, which is what I'm interested in sort of learning about and talking about.
Mm-hmm.
They go to Mexico first, and now there's a group in Los Angeles, a group in San Francisco, kind of some all over the place. There was a group in Arizona that's kind of
dispersed.
Died. But there's a fairly big group here in the Central Valley. The church is in Kerman. But now sort of all over Fresno County, and I've had a number of students over the years who take my Russian history class because they're Malakon and because they want to know more about it. So started to become more curious about it. And I knew about the Russian Malakons that were in Russia, but I didn't really know
that they would
that
be
they wound up here.
Yes.
So they're really interesting because it's a group that keeps their traditions. The church services in Russia, they wear like Russian clothing to church. They're pretty strict. They don't marry out. You marry someone else who's Malakon.
Oh.
You're supposed to raise your children in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like the Amish where you live in this enclosed community. They're going out. They're teachers. They're doctors. Mm-hmm. They're lawyers. They have jobs in the community.
They're integrated.
Mm-hmm. But they're still keeping this, what some people think is a pretty archaic faith.
Mm-hmm.
So I find it interesting the way in which they do that and the way in which it's really working and they're able to keep these both religious and cultural traditions alive. Lots like other immigrants. But also
takes
different.
A lot of balance on their part.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds like that's exciting. When are you doing this research with everything else that you do here?
It's a little bit stalled, but in an attempt to get it going, I'm actually taking an oral history class from one of our new faculty members who's teaching oral history and working on public history.
Oh, good.
And one of my assignments is to do a couple of oral histories. So it's sort of jumpstarting it so that I'll actually get it written.
Oh, I know that'll be exciting for you because to get to hear firsthand from a person is, I think that's the best experience. In your time here at Fresno State, you've been very involved as an advisor in a lot of different student groups. Tell us why you felt like that was an important use of your time and about some of the groups that you've been an advisor for.
Mostly in history, I was an advisor for the Pi Alpha Theta students. Partly, I think it's like the new girl's job. It keeps getting passed down. But partly, it's also a good way to connect with students who aren't necessarily your own students in your own classes.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I became dean, coincidentally, our ASI senator was really wanting to form a dean's group of students. And so for me, that was really important because I was missing the fact that I got to be with students and I got to have day-to-day contact with students. And so this student leadership council that is now a thing has been a great way for me to be able to call a student and say, what do you think about this? Could you guys talk to me about if we wanted to do a convocation, how would we do that? When I need a student to go with me to an event, I have a group of students that I can call on to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I hope, a good experience for them as well. They get to feel connected. They get to go to things they might not go to.
Yes.
And I get to stay in touch with what their concerns are and, you know, what their issues are. And
yes.
In a venue where I'm not the professor and I'm not just standing in front of the class and talking at them.
So that brings to mind, like, when you have such a long history of, I mean, you started as a lecturer back in 96, going all the way up to being a permanent dean. When you make that transition from being in the faculty role to being part of the administration, what are some of the challenges that you have dealt with or maybe surprises in making that transition? One is not getting to be with the students every day and having that personal interaction, which for me, I can't stand it when the campus is empty. In the summer, I don't like to come here because I love the energy of the students. I love their fresh ideas, their enthusiasm. It's why we're here.
Yeah.
And so I really appreciate you saying that finding ways for you to stay connected to them in one way is vital and important to you as a dean, because it could be very easy to just separate yourself from it and lose sight of that. What were some of the challenges when you transitioned into becoming part of administration that you felt like maybe you could impart to someone else who's thinking about going into that route?
Well, I joke that I was kind of an accidental dean. I was never planning to be dean or any kind of administrator. I love teaching. I still love teaching. It's still the thing that I miss about my current job. And I didn't really see myself as an administrator. I became dean because there was a leadership vacuum and there was an opportunity. And some of my friends were like, Michelle, you have to apply. And I'm like, I'm not going to apply. I don't. So finally, I agree because people are like, no, Michelle, this would be great. You should do this. And so I start the application. And at some point, I'm trying to come up with an administrative vita. And I'm like, I don't have anything. And
this friend
of mine, I call her. I say, I'm not going to do this. I'm not ready. I don't have the experience. And she's like, Michelle, I'm coming over. She says to me, you do know that men apply for jobs all the time, every day, that they're not actually qualified to do.
They stretch and
they do them anyway. So she comes over and she points out these things and we get my vita written and we get my letter written. Uh-huh. And I'm like, well, I'm still not going to get it anyway. So it doesn't really matter. I'm not going to worry about this. It's not going to happen. And lo and behold, I'm still here. Uh-huh. So clearly that didn't work out for me.
You know, sometimes we only see ourselves in a certain light and, you know, our comfort zone. But I like that your friends saw you as having the potential to do something different and that they encouraged you and they found a way to kind of drag you kicking and screaming into it. But, you know, when I interact with you and when I get to see you at different events as the dean, I think that it's a perfect fit for you. So I think it's wonderful that our true friends can see qualities in us that we don't recognize in ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely been a stretch for me. But when I took it, I began to realize that, in fact, I was kind of ready for something different, which I didn't see beforehand, that I was maybe getting a little stuck in my ways and it was time for me to learn some new things. I'm not a natural extrovert, so all the public events have been a real stretch. Mm-hmm. Public speaking for me is not my favorite. The first time I taught a class way back when, I broke out in hives the night before because I was nervous about talking to people. Obviously, I don't break out in hives when I talk to students anymore. But the first time I had to do graduation at the Save Mart Center, I'm like, oh, good grief, I'm not Beyonce. I don't want to do this.
It can be overwhelming.
It's a lot. So the public speaking part, I feel like I've gotten a lot better at. I feel like I'm not as good as some other deans I see. And just, you know, watching how people, I'm passionate about my college. I'm very passionate about the things my faculty do, the things the students do. But because I'm passionate about it, I want to represent them well. I don't want to go out there and just say things that are irrelevant.
But your passion and your enthusiasm come through. And I think that we're always our hardest judge.
Yeah.
But from someone who is the observer, I can tell you, you are Beyonce.
I don't know.
Well, some of the great things that you've worked on in your school have been creating a more robust American Indian Studies program. You launched a new geography and central and regional planning program and the Institute for Leadership and Public Policy. And then you brought back the Fresno State Gospel Choir, which I love. I think they're amazing. Is there anything else on the horizon that you're planning on bringing back or that you've got your eye on that's on a wish list as a dean?
Well, the Gospel Choir is still a work in progress. They're on a hiatus this year, but we're hoping to keep that revived next year. It's really important to me. It's really great to have this group that can represent us at public events.
Yes.
And get students involved who aren't necessarily like choir majors. So I think it's a good opportunity for students to do something that isn't always in their comfort zone.
Right.
I'm really working on, we have this institute through political science and Chicano Latin American studies that has been doing public opinion surveys. They have some internships for students, some fellowships for students that centers around leadership in public policy. We had some temporary funding. I'm really, really working to fund that on a more long-term basis. They do amazing work and I don't want it to die. So I'm really working on that. Just some leadership programs for students that we're working at. Mm-hmm. Lillian Faderman was here and we're going to start an oral history project about the history of women's studies.
Good.
As a result of that visit. The Fresno Women's Studies program was probably about the third in the country, so it's kind of a big deal, and we don't really have that history. So I think that'll be a really fun project. The Public History Project in History is really thriving, and they're doing all sorts of fun things.
Good.
So there's just a lot going on in my college. We've hired a bunch of young, new faculty who are doing all the kinds of digital projects that, for those people of my age, are a bit intimidating.
Yes.
They're really learning to teach in much more integrative ways than we would have taught when I was in graduate school.
Oh, what a wonderful experience for the students then. That's great. Now, another sidekick thing that you do, this last year you rode 545 miles with the AIDS Life Cycle Foundation. And I follow you on Facebook. I would see you all decked out and... You look like a glamour model at the end of the ride. I said, I would be just like hanging over the end of the bike unrecognizable, but then you're taking pictures. And I know that being able to work in that passion that you have for writing, and I also know it's a great stress reliever mm-hmm. for you, and pairing it with a cause that you feel deeply about was rewarding. But how do you push yourself to do something of that magnitude?
It's like learning Russian. I'm stubborn. And I'm super competitive, so I'm not willing to just like give up. When you're riding up a hill and you're like, I'm going to die. I don't see how I'm going to do this. Nope. Those other people, they're up there. I got to get up there. So for me, bicycling is also just fun. You're outside. You just keep turning the pedals and, you know, you can slow down. You don't have to go really super fast. You can just keep pedaling. The scenery is beautiful. The companionship is fun. And the AIDS ride is amazing because there are thousands of people doing it with you. And that's they have cheerleaders great. On the side and people handing out, you know, strawberries and candy.
There were costumes, too.
There's costumes. And random people just line the route with signs about a family member that died of AIDS or some reason this matters to them. And so riding that ride is actually fairly easy because there are all these people that keep you going. It's that the day-to-day training that's harder.
Yes. Now, your wife, Melissa, does she bike also?
She does bike. We're no longer biking together because I'm much more competitive than she is. And it doesn't go that well when we bike together. So we bike the same events sometimes, but we don't usually ride together.
So you don't train together?
We did train together some,
uh-huh.
but then I get in trouble because I'm like, no, it's fine. Just keep riding. We rode a 200-mile ride in Oregon, and she got food poisoning.
Oh, no.
But I didn't know she had poison. She didn't know either. And I was a really bad person, and I was like, you can do this. You're just stressed. Keep riding. I don't understand why you can't keep up.
Okay.
And then I felt really bad because she was actually really sick and I was a terrible person. But
so how many bouquets of roses did it take you to come back from that one? Because that's pretty bad.
It was not good. But she finished.
Good for her.
That's amazing. Well, thank you for everything that you do for our campus and for our students and for keeping them at the center of what drives you to think of creative ways that your college can grow and to best serve the university and the community. And I'm in awe, and I'm a fan, and you've known it for a while that I'm a fan of yours. And I am particularly drawn to how you find areas to look at and to highlight that have been forgotten. And you give light to those women that didn't mm-hmm. get the recognition they needed. And you give light to these groups that exist among us, but for a lot of people would be invisible.
Yeah.
And I think that is a unique talent, and it's a great thing for a person to choose that as what they want to spend their time doing. And so I admire you for that. And I thank you for coming and being our guest today.
Thank you so much, Mary.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, thanks again to our very special guest, the Dean of the College of Social Sciences at Fresno State, Dr. Michelle Denbesty. And of course, my co-host, Fresno State's First Lady, Mrs. Mary Castro. Thanks for joining us this morning, and please join us again next Sunday morning at 10 for another First Ladies Focus on KFSR. We're on the air at 90.7 FM and streaming worldwide at KFSR.org.
KFSR presents First Ladies Focus every Sunday morning at 10. For a complete program schedule, visit KFSR.org.